Welcome to News Talking. Doug McCulloch is currently a North Carolina Court of Appeals judge. He's formerly a federal prosecutor and was directly involved in the pursuit and prosecution of the principal players of maybe the largest drug smuggling ring in U.S. history. And he gives us the inside story of bringing drug kingpins and low-level operatives to justice and eventually resulting in the arrest of Manuel Noriega of Panama. All that on today. And I've got a special treat for all his Chapel Hill fans. Bernie Rees is a good friend of Judge Doug McCulloch. And
McCullough.
And has agreed to sort of be my guest host. And so, Bernie, tell us about this book and tell us about your friendship with the judge. And,
well, first, being on the same side of the table with you is a bit distracting for me, but I'll try to do the best I can. I met Doug McCulloch when he attended the Raleigh Spy Conference in 2008, was it, Doug?
I think so.
And we talked, and he was saying he's working on this story and had this draft of a manuscript, actually. And I said, well, let me look at it. So he sent it to me, and I was intrigued from the beginning, even though it was in very rough shape, because it was about, as you described, kind of like people we know compositely. These weren't heroin dealers, Jamaican cocaine dealers. These were kids, college-type kids.
In North Carolina, on the North Carolina coast.
In the North Carolina coast, even though they weren't from North Carolina. But the operation ended up being, which is so funny to me, because it was like the pirates of old. Why do they choose North Carolina's coast? Because of the shallow waters and the sandbars and the inaccessibility for large boats. And so they were unloading lots of marijuana. And Doug was prosecutor for the Federal Eastern District for the United States and ended up investigating this drug ring. And it involved all sorts of people on the coast where Doug's from, near there. He's from Carteret and near Swansboro. And I got fascinated and published the first chapter of this very rough draft in Metro Magazine. And we had as much interest in that feature than anything I think we'd ever run before. I mean, people were just fascinated by it. But Doug then took a while for him to finally figure out how to get it published. And I'll let him pick it up from there, Doug. So you got it self-published first?
Well, I have two muses about this. My wife, when later marriage for both of us, she found my materials in a box when we were moving, and she says, you've got to write this story down. I had tried to write a screenplay, found I didn't know anything about that, and had just abandoned the project. And she said, turn it into a book. So the screenplay scenes became chapters in the book, Sea of Greed. And then I was an intel officer in the Marine Corps Reserves. I went to Bernie's spy conference out of curiosity about the area that he was covering, spies and intelligence and everything. Told him about my project. He was the other person who lit a fire under me to get this book finished, because he said, Doug, you've got to finish this book. People are calling in and want to know where they can get it. And so I've worked furiously to clean it up, make it a readable, real book. Tried to get an agent to peddle it to the bigger markets and the publishers, and finally gave up on the agent that I had and just self-published it. Now, as of this past fall, I have become a published author. So I've crossed over that. This story has got enough legs on it that it's gotten into the whole arena. Now you can buy the book anywhere you can find it.
Well, Bernie, get him to tell us the bare bones of the story. That's in the book, just from the beginning. I love this excerpt in Metro where you talk about your entrance into a kind of a strange entrance into this story.
Two Coast Guardsmen on routine patrol in a day when the Coast Guard was not nearly as professional as they are today. Back then, they carried a unloaded sidearm, .45 pistol, and two magazines in a pouch on their left side of their war belt. So they're unloaded gun. And they're coming out, and they see a couple of lights coming in Beaufort.
Are they in the ship or on ground? Or are they in?
They're in a what we call the rubber rigid inflatable that you've seen that looks like a rubber craft just big enough for two people or maybe four people.
What are they doing?
They're just on routine law enforcement safety patrol. The main thing they thought they were going to do is they had seen some people rafting up for a big floating cocktail party, and he wanted to go clear those sailboats out and make sure they had gone to mooring.
And well, where this is?
And this is at Atlantic Beach, Fort Macon Coast Guard Station in Beaufort Inlet, town of Beaufort, Morehead City. So they look out toward the sea, and they see that two lights are coming in very far out, and they're going to run aground. And so now they start to render assistance. Then they see the first light come back in the channel, then the second light comes back in the channel. And so they're curious of who's leading who into the channel just at dusk. Finally, they get up to a small boat that's headed in toward Taylor's Creek, for those people who are familiar with the Beaufort waterfront. And it's got some very unusual characters in it. First of all, they weren't from around here. One was a Colombian. This is the 80s. He's in stacked heels, think Saturday Night Fever. He's got gold chains, black hair.
Is he in his boat then? Or is
he's
he,
in the boat as one of the passengers.
You can see him? You can sort of see him from there?
This is a small runabout type boat, like a John boat. Or a Carolina skiff or something of that nature. And there's five guys in it, and they heard something go sploosh over the side when they approached him. One of the Coast Guardsmen triangulated where he was, and the next day we found the ID and a .357 pistol down at the bottom of the drink. One of the Beaufort Police Department divers picked it up. But they questioned these guys. They got a really iffy story about fishing. They had they didn't have the right kind of tackle to do the kind of fishing they had set on board. They had some beer, they had some scuba gear, and they realized they were being lied to, so they went looking for the shrimper that they had seen chug by them, which was the second light. As they're questioning these guys, they went looking for the other one. They found him over in Morehead City at the fuel docks, and one of the Coast Guardsmen goes on board. Now he notices this is very, very unusual, this shrimper, because first of all, they're saying things that he knew were not true. Like, it isn't shrimp season. Well, it was shrimp season. That's exactly why the boat had to lay offshore for a day or two and try to run in, because marine fisheries out boarding the shrimpers to make sure they'd paid for their revenues, tax stamps. So he hears a shotgun rack around behind him. He has an unloaded gun. He talks his way off the boat. He gets with his partner. They have to go look for a payphone because they realize the communications equipment on board was sophisticated enough that they could be overheard. We don't have scramblers, don't have cell phones. It's that era. And so they found a payphone down the waterfront, call. By that time, they had lost eyesight of the boat. The station responds. They send some local police department cars to respond. They go find the boat. Now it's tied up by its nose at the state port, and it's empty of people. But there's 29,000 pounds of marijuana on board.
Well, so all the people that they saw disappeared.
They fled. And a lot of other people were in town, and they also fled, as we later found out. The people who were going to be the offloaders and lookouts and the guard boats and all of the people involved in marijuana smuggling.
The drugs are not this high-powered stuff that we think of. It's, I don't want to say just marijuana, but it's a drug that would be at the lowest level of your worry, wouldn't it?
Except it was 29,000 pounds of it.
Put 29,000 pounds in perspective, both in terms of dollar volume and how much of the hull it took. Did it fill the boat up?
In 1982 dollars, it's probably about $15 to $20 million, which would still be a lot of money today. But that's in 1982 dollars in buying power, about 10 times as much in buying power. The marijuana was quite potent because it was considered Colombian gold was kind of the gold standard of marijuana, and this came from Colombia. Back in that day, shrimpers from North Carolina used to go work the Gulf. And so you would see shrimp boats transiting from North Carolina down to the Gulf and back. And so it was not unusual to see boats go down and do that. And so it's just a slight diversion to going down to Colombia, pick up a load and bring it back. And the Florida and Gulf Coast were getting just a little bit hot with law enforcement activity, and people were always looking for other places that would be secure. And just like Bernie said, North Carolina became attractive to a lot of these folks because we had back then, the coastline was not developed. The area where they smuggled into was actually owned by Weyerhaeuser and was just standing trees. That was their actual offload destination. Wow. And they eventually figured out that this seizure was a fluke, that they could come back and do it again. And they did. About 4 months later, in November of 1982, they ran a load of 39,000 pounds in and unloaded it successfully. They had Teamster drivers come down.
How'd you find out about that?
Well, eventually I solved this case. It took me four years.
So this was not something that you knew immediately.
No.
Did you know about, when did you learn about that first, the first offloading?
I learned about that the day it happened. I was called down to the port by the Customs and DEA, said, hey, we've got a big seizure here. And so I learned about the seizure of the 29,000 pounds immediately. But we did a lot of investigation that was useful in a prosecution, but we couldn't identify who the people were.
Well, what did you, this is interesting to me because the people that the Coast Guard officers or the Coast Guard men had seen are all gone. So you've got a boat and you've got some marijuana, but you don't have any witnesses or you don't have any
We didn't
people.
Have any people.
How did you find them?
Eventually.
But not
years.
Right away.
Not right away.
Well, what did you, I mean, what do you do sitting scratching so your head up in your office thinking?
We compiled the investigation that we could. We had some suspicious characters, but we didn't know who they were. Had rented beach cottages in Emerald Isle. We had a boat that had been purchased by locally with cash. And it was abandoned.
This is the boat that had
the small boat that had
not the one that had the. This is the guide boat, or it was
the guide boat.
And the guide boat.
And it was
what about
abandoned.
The boat? What about the boat that was abandoned that had the marijuana stash?
Well,
in
we seized that one ourselves.
And where did it? Did
we,
you?
We
did
ended
it,
up selling that.
Did you find out where it came from?
Oh yes, we found out where it came from, and it came from Louisiana, from Houma, Houma, Louisiana, and the people were water people down there. They claimed that they had leased the boat to some people that they didn't know and didn't have any way of contacting, but they did have a charter boat lease. They went to court to try to get their boat back, but we beat them in court and kept the boat because they were grossly negligent in their rental of the boat.
Did you have a suspicion they were more than negligent?
We knew they were part of it, but we just couldn't prove it. And they felt a good defense is best if you use an offense. So they went to court to fight to get their boat back as if they were innocent and when they were actually part of the ring. And I did prosecute them and put them in jail later.
Oh, you did. Well, listen, we got to take a break. We're visiting about a book that has newly published, Sea of Greed, by a Court of Appeals judge. And, Judge, if I say the last name McCullough wrong.
You got it right. Yeah. I've heard it pronounced many different ways, D.G., so.
Our great friend Bernie Reeves is our co-host, and all three of us will be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest host, your favorite radio personality, Bernie Reeves, and I are having the privilege to talk about a book by Court of Appeals judge whose book...
Doug McCullough.
I'm going to get... better get the judge's
name
right.
Thank God I'm right. Here.
Better get the judge's name right if I'm ever going to be appearing in his court.
Just get the book right.
Sea of Greed.
What you been smoking, DJ?
If you joined us late, we've been talking about a really interesting incident that took place many years ago on the North Carolina coast in which two Coast Guard people wound up seizing a ship full of marijuana, maybe in today's dollars, and close to $100 million, but a lot of money. Anyway.
Well, towards the end, their last effort was, I mean, 3 million pounds, is that right?
That was planned.
We'll get to that in a second.
Well, Bernie, you're going to take him
well,
on.
Well, I was going to say before, because I remember what I remember of what we published and reading the manuscript, and one part of it that we're talking about since we're back in the beginning when they unloaded in North Carolina and why North Carolina, which is fascinating because anybody who studied the Pirates era, middle 1700s, knows that North Carolina's sandbars and shallow water was a great refuge for pirates and was a great refuge for drug smugglers in the 80s. But I remember vividly the process of unloading that boat and all the people coming from around the towns in the area and how systematic and well-oiled a machine they had. Right, Doug? They would you mind picking it up and just explaining just quite how did they deliver that and then move on, as you...
The fellow who is in the book and is really the protagonist of the book, more than the investigators, we follow more the conspirators because their side is really the most interesting side of any smuggling tale. He had a group of guys he had hung out with from high school days when he was selling pot in high school, and they were his schoolyard customers and buddies. He was a high school dropout.
Is he this North Carolina boy?
Or no, he's from Houston, Texas. And all these people were from Houston. So they flew. What they actually did is they came in 2 weeks early. They took beach cottages at Emerald Isle and motel rooms down at Emerald Isle, stayed away from the Moorhead area, told everybody that they were there because they were construction crew that worked together, and they came in early on a job, and the boss gave them 2 weeks at the beach as a reward. And they would go fishing every day. Well, they fished right offside the Coast Guard station, and they recorded when the boats came and went. Uh-huh. They listened over the – now, they had some local help here. They listened to the radio and found out where the sheriff's car, the highway patrol cars would be, and they charted out pretty much what the routines were by watching them for 2 weeks and seeing what their routine patrol habits were. And the way they came to North Carolina was quite interesting. A young man from North Carolina, from Beaufort, had just opened a restaurant in downtown Beaufort. Some of you might have eaten there at the Net House. It's now been sold, and it's called the Salt Works, I believe. But it was the Net House for 25 years, and he had just opened it. He'd gone to Atlanta, and he saw this young man really playing the role. He had on flashy clothes, a big wad of money. He's sending champagne over to all the pretty girls, and he's got a Rolex on, and it's just everything is just too unbelievable that this person is in a legitimate enterprise. So he approached him and said, I don't know if you're in the import-export business, but if you are in that business, I think I know a place you would be very interested in.
Now, when he said import-export,
that was
they
code
knew,
for smuggling.
And they knew it was drugs.
Everybody kind of used that term and bandied it about. Well, and at first, this guy, of course, is very nervous. He thinks maybe this is an undercover cop. And it took him a while to feel him out and see that he was legitimate, and then he did come to Beaufort, and he did tour the area where the offload would be, and he met the mayor of Atlantic Beach. He met a local bodybuilder and physical trainer who actually trained police officers in martial arts, and those two were two of the local guys. And then we had another local guy who said he'll show him how to put the boats in the water and be a boat handler for him and take them fishing and do and help run the guard boat. And then he's the one who abandoned the boat at the Emerald Isle Marina later on when things went south. But they watched the police, they watched the Coast Guard, they had a Teamsters driver come down, they bought shrimp, and they put the marijuana in the front of the tractor trailer, and they put the shrimp at the rear of the tractor trailer, and they had a manifest for shrimp from a legitimate fish house.
Now, this I am confused because I thought the Coast Guard guys impounded the boat.
Well, they did. Everybody was there waiting, though. They were already
They were
there.
All ready to do that.
They were ready to do it.
They had the shrimp.
That night. And they were going to do it. That night, the Coast Guard gets the shrimper. The word went out right away that they had been grabbed. Everybody starts scampering like rats running.
I'm real interested in the restaurant owner and what his background was and why he was so aggressive in looking for this import-export business when he had a restaurant to take care of and he had,
well,
did he have a background?
He's a young guy and he's right out of college. His father was a chef at a restaurant in New Bern, the Harvey Mansion, which is in downtown New Bern, old house that's been converted to a restaurant. He had been in college, but he was had taken out a big loan for the restaurant, and I think he saw this guy. It clicked in his mind that if I could get $50,000, $100,000, I could
just
pay that
do it
loan
one time, do maybe
a one time
deal.
Deal, because in talking to these people, they never hit the same place more than once or twice, and then they're going to move their operation before anybody in the local area could figure out who they were or what they were. They would wisp away, if you will, so and remain a ghost to people like me in law enforcement. So he brought them to North Carolina, and as soon as they saw the North Carolina coast, it looked so different where they had been smuggling down in Galveston and in Texas. You had to go into marinas, and everything's built up, and they have high-rise condos on the beach, and it's a totally different type of operation. And marijuana smuggling is time-intensive. It takes a long time to unload 29,000 pounds at 50 pounds per load. So they had a conveyor belt. And they put it just like in a warehouse. You slide that conveyor, use the conveyor belt to slide your 50-pound bale down to the end, and a bale humper has to pick that bale up and physically carry it, stumbling through the brush and everything from the water's edge to where the truck could be on a dirt road.
There. And when it's loaded and at, removed from the embarkation or the point where it's unloaded, and where do they take it? Where does it go? How's it distributed?
These particular guys were hooked up with some mob-type people from Detroit, the Rio brothers, and they took it to their construction company warehouse in Detroit. So they left and they had...
Left and got on the interstates and are out of here.
And back in those days, there were not as many dogs working the roads. And if you were a Teamster driver and you were routinely in the South hauling loads to different northern cities, and you show them a manifest with shrimp, and at the very back end of your, through the inspection door, if they wanted to inspect, there would be shrimp. It was, you know, the chances of getting caught were very slim. Their most vulnerable point on the road, frankly, was when they come out of the woods on the Back Creek area of in down east Carteret County and get on the first paved road. If there had been a patrol car coming along at 2 o'clock in the morning and saw that, that's what they were worried about. Once he got on the road and was moving into commerce, they were pretty sure he was going to make it, and he did.
Well,
in November.
Bernie Reeves and I are visiting with Judge Doug McCullough about his book, Sea of Greed. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, we're talking about drug smuggling. We're talking about it with a Court of Appeals judge who formerly was a federal prosecutor who brought some of these drug smugglers to justice, Judge Doug McCullough, about, and we're talking about his book, Sea of Greed. And my favorite guest is now our guest host. And Bernie, you're sort of leading this discussion. Where should we go now?
Well, I don't think I'm leading it so much, but I do go back to the beginning with Doug, as we discussed earlier when we published that excerpt in our Metro magazine and helped him get him off, get moving on the book. But the business about how it all happened on the east coast of North Carolina is so important. I think we've laid that groundwork. But if I were to pick the next thing that I personally remember vividly is the problem with this drug smuggling. And don't forget, this is marijuana smuggling. It's not cocaine and heroin and all the dangerous drugs you hear about now and prescription drugs and all that. It's sort of like a college fraternity drug ring, if you ask me. But the problem they had, DJ and Doug will now pick up on, what do we do, how do we count, and how do we dispose of all this money?
Yeah, well, are you going to ask him to tell us that?
And that's what I'm hoping he will. Since he's in the same room, I think he heard me.
39,000 pounds came in the fall of 82. The guys had plenty of money after that. They had the philosophy that, well, if you're going to get caught, you might as well get caught with a big load as a small load because there's no difference in the penalties. And if you're going to run this risk, then you might as well make a lot of money. So the next load, they got all their guys down to the Grand Cayman Islands for a New Year's Eve bash to celebrate their success in November and told them their plan, which was to take an ocean-going barge, put 300,000 pounds of marijuana on board the barge, and have a tug push it up the Mississippi River until they got to Lafayette, Louisiana. They did that successfully. They left 20,000 pounds that was wet in the scuppers of the barge because it was not sellable. And so if you hear people talking about square groupers that are found in the water, they found something that couldn't be sold anyway. So don't let any of them bamboozle you by saying that they made money out of square groupers. They don't. Wet marijuana with salt water doesn't sell. They went to Detroit. They distributed it. Now they have over $50 million in cash in a house in Tampa, Florida, right, under shotgun guard, money being counted with money counters that we found, two that were burned out from counting that much money.
24/7, right?
24/7. The Cuban women were naked when they counted the money, and the Cuban guys that are guarding them are carrying shotguns because they don't want any women grabbing some of their money that they're not entitled to and leaving. But that money is the money that was laundered into Panama with Noriega's assistance, and he took a mere 15%. But they had no choice but to pay him, because otherwise they have money and a house in Tampa. You have to get it into a bank.
So they got lots of money. It's all in cash.
It's all in cash.
And so their problem now, having been successful in their drug operation, is getting the money in a place where they can use it, because they can't just spend it. They can't
think about this house with all the naked women 24/7 counting $50 million. I mean, Doug, can you give us an idea what $50 million looks like size-wise?
It was stacked. It was in a small three-bedroom center block house that you would see in any show on TV. Cops shows people in those lower rent neighborhoods where the cinder block houses are being visited by the police, and the rooms are rather small, but the money is stacked floor to ceiling against the wall, and they're counting out in the middle, and they have to wear masks because it's toxic when to get that much money in a confined, unventilated space. And so they're wearing little face masks, and they're counting the money, and they're bundling it up, and they fly it on private airplanes. The ringleader had a Learjet, and he would fly it into Panama, and then the plane would go over to the military side of the airport where DEA couldn't surveil it. On the commercial side, they could surveil it. And then a military escort would escort Stephen Kalish and his money to a Panamanian bank where he would deposit it under various accounts, which now could be used. And then, of course, Noriega raked off his cut. I didn't know any of this because I didn't have a witness.
You all have led me to believe that this was sort of a fraternity boy operation. This sounds highly professional when you're counting, not getting, you know, and you're dealing with this amount of money.
I didn't mean, what I meant was that they're not a bunch. If you see a drug interdiction television show or read a drug interdiction story today, it is full of murder and mayhem and dangerous drugs. I mean, all I meant by that reference was this was in the more innocent days of just marijuana. That's all I'm saying.
Gotcha.
And these guys were adverse to violence. They really were not violent. They didn't even carry guns on the boat when they had the marijuana. They were all unarmed. It was not like scenes of Miami Vice and the cocaine cowboys that came as the next wave of smugglers.
Exactly.
How did you connect this first little sighting in off the shore in Beaufort and Norwood City, and where it was a one-time deal with people who scattered and a lot of local folks involved, then all of a sudden it's millions and millions of dollars.
Well, how Kalish met Noriega might help with that, too.
Well, Kalish met Noriega through
Let's see, I don't have any idea who Kalish is.
Kalish is the principal smuggler, and he's the logistics
and
guy.
And he had organized
organization.
This first thing that you told us about off the North Carolina coast. He was there, or was he just organizing it from afar?
No, he was there.
Was he on the boat?
No, he was on the ground waiting to supervise the offload crews. Stephen Kalish was the logistician. A guy named Lee Rich was the connection to the Colombian traffickers who would give them the pot. And there was a guy in Detroit named Michael Vogel who handled distribution. So those were the three principals in the ring. But Michael, the way we connected the dots on this investigation is Michael Vogel got angry with one of the persons who worked for them, who was their security director, for lack of a better word. He screened the offload crews to make sure he thought they were reliable. He had ticked Vogel off and cost Vogel some money. So Vogel had him shot. And God does protect drunks, because he had a shotgun blast to the stomach, but he was totally dead drunk. And it didn't hurt him as bad as it would you or me. And they looked at him, left him for dead, and he crawled to a telephone and called 911. So if you get shot, Detroit's the place to get shot, because they've got plenty of experience in handling gunshot wounds, because he lived. And an FBI agent approached him and said, "Your brothers have been telling me a rather fantastic story. Do you want to tell that story to the U.S. attorney down in North Carolina under a grant of immunity, or do you want to take your chances on the street and see if they can improve their aim?" And he decided he would become our witness. And since he was the one person who knew everybody in the organization top to bottom, I now had a witness who could link all this little pieces of evidence together and tell a coherent story. And then we could start drafting indictments and arresting people. And that's what happened.
So this witness, who was delivered to you courtesy of an angry insider, spilled the beans for you and opened the door.
And that's my title, Sea of Greed. It was his greed and the anger that greed spawned in him that led us to have the witness that linked everybody together. And then we found out some really startling facts about some of the people that had been involved that we didn't know. We knew the names of the people who had the boat, because and they came to court and identified themselves. And, of course, he linked them to the conspiracy. We could now arrest them. He gave us the names of the people who had rented the house in Emerald Isle, or the beach houses in Emerald Isle. And now we had photographs, and we could show them to the realtors and get confirmation. So all those pieces of evidence started falling together to make a good prosecution. But what we didn't know was that a guy named Doc McGee had loaned him the money to start the business off, and Doc McGee was the manager for Bon Jovi and Motley Crue.
And what was he going to get out of it? Some high interest rate?
He loaned him two, and they paid him back three, $100,000. So he paid some initial expenses. They lost the load. They came back to Doc, and they said, Doc, we lost that first $100,000 because the Coast Guard seized the load. Loan us another $100,000 or you'll never get paid. So Doc loaned him another $100,000, and they delivered him a Christmas present that year of $300,000. So he made $100,000 on his loan of $200,000.
Now, when Bon Jovi was busted, and my friend Joe Cheshire, and you're, of course, no Joe, came up with a compromise sentencing where they had to perform an anti-drug concert in Russia or something. Help me with that.
Yes, we went to federal court with Doc McGee, and, and I'm saying to the judge that he ought to be sentenced like anybody else. And Joe Cheshire says, this man is so unique, he could turn this culture around.
Yeah.
And the federal judge that was sentencing him said, he would probably say today his sentence was a mistake. But Doc McGee was sentenced to probation, and as a condition of probation, he had to throw three anti-drug rock concerts around the globe. And he threw, one of them was in Russia, one of them was here in Chapel Hill,
right,
and one of them was in Raleigh. And therefore, he completed his probation successfully. Doc McGee now manages Gene Simmons' Kiss. He doesn't manage Bon Jovi. It had nothing to do with his conviction. It was all about business and money.
When I showed the book to my friend Gus Guzler, who owns the Players Retreat now, he's a lawyer, entertainment lawyer, and he is the lawyer and whatever for Bon Jovi and Doc McGee. And I didn't connect what had happened with Cheshire's sentencing compromise and Doc McGee. And the first thing Gus says, I can't touch this with a 10-foot pole. You know, he was a lawyer for Bon Jovi and Doc McGee. So he was running from it as fast as he could. But that's a little extra, I think, a great sidebar.
It's a great
sidebar. People will love knowing about.
There are lots of great sidebars to this story. I wish we could have time to do all of them. We're going to have to take a quick break. Bernie Rees, my co-host, and I are visiting with Judge Doug McCullough, and we're talking about his book, Sea of Greed. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, my cohort, co-host Bernie Rees.
Cohort, too.
And I are visiting with the North Carolina Appeals Court Judge Doug McCullough. We're talking about a different time in his life, in when he was a federal prosecutor, and a great adventure that he had that he's sharing with us. And he shared in his book called Sea of Greed, which is newly revised, republished, updated, and doing pretty well, I think. Doug, it's
I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
I've become
good.
A published author, so now I have the opportunity to reach everybody in America.
There you go.
Well, I feel fortunate to have been around at the birthing of this, but in trying to help you in this co-hosting, and we were trying to get to the sort of end point here, like you were talking about. And as I recall, Doug, and you can pick it up, Kalish, who was the main leader of this famous drug ring, started in North Carolina, ended up with the invasion of Panama, which is what the story really is, met Noriega because Kalish had bought a house in Panama.
Yes, he bought a real swanky condominium in Panama, and it became the after five watering hole for a lot of the people who hung around Noriega. Some of the senior generals, diplomats, people of that nature started coming to Kalish's place, and he always had an open bar and a big spread and servants and all of that sort of thing, and they were eating and drinking for free. It's kind of like if you open the bar and say there's free drinks, you're going to have a crowd. And that's
like Raleigh in the old days when the truckers had free breakfast for the legislators.
There you go. You would get a crowd. And so Kalish and Noriega became very friendly, and Kalish even bought an aircraft for the Panamanian Air Force, and the Panamanian government was paying him, and we ended up confiscating those payments. But he had a Learjet, and Noriega liked to fly on the Learjet, so Kalish flew Noriega to Washington, D.C. to get an award from President Reagan for his cooperation on the war on drugs. Yeah, and then Kalish right. flew him to Las Vegas so he could party with showgirls before he went back to back home. And I have a picture in the book of this that Las Vegas iconic Las Vegas sign because my wife is an ex-Las Vegas showgirl, first well. Job out of high school. And she wanted that picture in the book, so I said, yes, ma'am.
The beautiful Lucci, yes.
But Noriega flew into Andrews Air Force Base on Kalish's plane. Well, the FBI arrested Kalish just before he was leaving to never come back and go to Panama and stay. And we just barely got him at the airport. We have Kalish in custody. I'm having a little bit of a turf war between Tampa and me. They wanted to kick me off the turnip truck. Think I'm just, you know, I'm the country.
So your federal prosecutor down there thinks he's got the
case. Yeah, but he didn't have dope on the table that I did, and he didn't have the...
What does that mean, dope on the table?
That means I had actually seized drugs in a conspiracy.
And what was his connection?
Well, they had a conspiracy investigation, and conspiracy is just you testifying against me, and then we corroborate it. But I had the corroboration in the fact that I had...
And who makes that decision? Does Attorney General make the decision?
No, the local U.S. attorney.
Well, I mean, but you've got two different local
yeah,
U.S. attorneys.
Yeah, that's why we were fighting.
But the Tampa office, though, was more concerned with the conspiracy about laundering money, weren't they?
They were. Yeah, and yeah. I was more concerned about the conspiracy to import. So we made a deal that I would prosecute for importation, they would prosecute for conspiracy, because I had a lot of people, you know, the mayor of Atlantic Beach, the restaurant owner, and all the people that were local, that they didn't have any interest in prosecuting. And so, but that's a big deal to us. So we eventually reached an agreement on that part of it. I took Kalish on the day of his arraignment on his charges here in North Carolina. I took him to Camp Lejeune and had the provost marshal provide us security, and we had a meeting out there, and I had the Customs, DEA, and FBI all interview him simultaneously about his cooperation. And those reports went up through their respective, to their respective headquarters. And when that hit the national level, it went to the National Security Council, and Reagan said, indict him. And today, the day we're being interviewed.
Indict Kalish.
No, indict
Noriega. Based on what Kalish
had told
so
him.
So Kalish became a cooperative witness.
And he testified at Noriega's trial.
And what did you all give him to be cooperative?
Well, we ultimately decided that we would leave it to the judge's discretion, and the judge that was going to sentence him would be in Tampa, and he would get a concurrent sentence in North Carolina. And we went to Tampa, and we told the judge what he had done, and he was facing 30 years, and he got 14. So, and he served of that 14, he served about 8.5 because we had parole back in those days.
And but, so he's out. He's what's he doing? What have you kept up with him?
Yes, I have kept up with him. As a matter of fact, and Kalish went straight. He went to Santa Monica, set up a computer company, and he developed the software that allows you to send an e-card today. And he cashed out for about $30 million, and and a small percentage of every e-card sent. So every time you send an e-card, you're putting money in Stephen Kalish's pocket.
That's interesting. Now, explain to me how we Noriega got connected to this, and how you brought him down.
Well, Kalish's interviews that I. Where I debrief him along with those various federal agencies, that was the catalyst for bringing Noriega down. Wow. Because once it was said that he was going to be indicted, then the Attorney General did get involved, and he said, the prosecution will be in Miami. Turn over all of your evidence that you have.
So you had to give it up.
So we gave all of our assistance to the trial team. And then
in your book, do you cover that? Do you follow that up?
I cover it in the afterward.
Afterward.
Yes.
Great.
But they had to go get Noriega to bring him to the United States.
No, we don't have time to talk about that.
And that's what the invasion of Panama was all about that everybody watched on the news.
So all of this investigation ultimately.
Read Sea of Greed.
There you go. Sea of Greed.
By Doug McCullough.
Doug McCullough. Thank you. And Bernie Reese, thanks for coming back. We miss you over here. Again, the book is Sea of Greed. The webpage for Sea of Greed is
Sea of Greed Book. SeaofGreedBook.com.
Thanks, Doug McCullough. Thanks, Brady
Thank
Reese.
You.
Thanks to you for listening. DG Martin, who's talking? I'll be back here before you know it.